This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
I'm so glad to welcome you to the Clark Howard Show, where our mission is to serve you and empower you so you make better financial decisions in your life. The spring's here, and that makes me so happy. I love it when the days get longer, and I love this debate going on in Congress about having daylight shift all year long. I can't believe how controversial that is with people. But anyway, the other thing is that it's the time, if you have teenagers, to start thinking, get them focused on not today, not 1 minute from now, like my teenagers have all done, but to get them thinking about when school's out and summer jobs. And so I want to talk about that. And if you're a teacher and you're off for the summer, gosh, I can't remember a year where you could pick up a temporary job paying more per hour than you can right now. And later, you're going to think I lost my mind. But I have high praise for one of the four giant monster mega banks. Yep, got to call them as I see them. And one deserves real credit today. And I'm going to let you know what they've done. So in the job market, what's happened is something that economists have been marveling at, and that is pay rates are going up the fastest in entry-level jobs and going up at slower rates for people particularly who work in corporate career-type jobs. Corporations tend to have a workforce, the bigger the corporation, the more they have a workforce that is more risk averse, values job security over everything else, and is more likely to be someone who's in there for the long haul for longevity. And those bureaucratic large corporate entities, even in a time where we're facing higher inflation, are going to be, I wouldn't call it stingy, but they're going to be reluctant to give raises that fit with what's going on with the cost of living. Because in their mind, they have a workforce that's more into all the benefits they give and the stability and security that may come with working for a giant bureaucratic corporation. But people that are in more entry-level kind of jobs where there's an extreme shortage of workers, mainly because of what's happened with an aging population in the United States, because of that, regardless of your age, the pay rates have been going up and up and up and up. I mean, I think about when that movement for 15 started, what was that, like 7-8 years ago, to have a minimum wage be $15 an hour at a time. The federal minimum wage is still, it's irrelevant now, isn't it? It's like $7 and something. Krista, can you look that up? $7.25 an hour. It's become so irrelevant that I don't even remember. And it was like, you got to be kidding. They want the minimum wage to be 15. Well, now the marketplace has taken minimum wages up and up and up that employers are offering. Target got a lot of publicity recently when they said, depending on the market, their minimum could go as high as $24 an hour. And so the ability for a teenager with these extreme labor shortages or someone just looking for temporary or part-time work to earn a really great hourly rate right now is the best it's ever been. I can't remember when it's been that good. And so the highest paying jobs are the ones that obviously are going to be the most sought after, And getting your teenager focused on it in the next few weeks would be a much better idea than, like most teenagers, who once the weekend's over of the last week of school, that's when it'll be like, oh, well, I guess I should go look for a job.
That'll be my boy.
You ever had a teenager like that, Kristen?
Oh, yes, I definitely do.
I've had one, three like that.
One wasn't like that, but this guy's making up for it. So,
you know, just play this segment of the podcast for your teenager. Maybe I should do that with my son.
I got to tell you something really funny real quick. I was in Hawaii recently, very lucky to be on spring break trip to Hawaii with my daughter, a couple of her college friends, and another mom. The other mom also has a 16-year-old. One day while we're there in Hawaii, a few days in, she gets a call from her son, and he asks her to heat up some food because he's coming home briefly in a little while. And she was like, I'm in Hawaii. Isn't that like so typical? Like he was like, oh, you're still there.
Didn't even remember that she wasn't there.
I mean, they lived together full time. So anyway, I just thought that was hilarious. But yeah,
well,
got to get it, got to prod them a little.
Yeah, opportunity's knocking right now. And while you're at it, if you can afford it as a parent, I call it the mommy-daddy match. Offer to your teenager any money they saved this summer from their work. You will match whatever formula you do. With my kids, I always did dollar for dollar, and open up a Roth IRA with them. The easiest place to do that really is Fidelity Investments. And you go open up that Roth with your kid, and you're a custodian for them till they're an adult. And you start building, there's double advantage to it. You build, hopefully, a lifelong habit of saving part of what you make. And second, money saved by a teenager is like, it's like a mega force, because that money has so much more time to grow and grow and grow and double approximately every 8 to 10 years. I mean, it's enormous benefit, since most people don't really, I mean, truth be told, most people don't really get into saving for the future till they're 40. If you get that habit in a kid at 15, 16, I always made my kids start working at 15 because I'm an ogre. Anyway, if you get your kid as a teen, mid-teen, late teen, into this thing of, hey, you know, I instead of spending money on that, I give that much to mom or dad, and then I get it matched dollar for dollar or whatever match you do, there's an enormous incentive, because you're saying, hey, instantly you're going to double your money. Or if you do 50 cents for each dollar, they're getting a 50% return on their money instantly for saving it instead of spending it. And you're able to teach them what a Roth IRA is. You're able to have them have real money in the game, understand the basics of investing that money. I think it's great.
Great stuff. Okay, we'll get to some questions now. This is from Darlene in Georgia. I've been applying to home care agencies for a job. Part of filling out the paperwork is they want copies of things like my driver's license. One of the cards they want a copy of is my Social Security card. I've given them my Social Security number on all the forms I filled out for them. I think I remember Clark saying not to give out your Social Security number, but I believe when applying for a job, you know, the jobs that she's applying for ask for a background check and fingerprinting. I was wondering if I should also show them my actual Social Security card.
There's no problem once you have to breach that. And you give somebody access to your Social Security number, giving them a copy of your card is no problem at all. So you can do that because you've already done the big thing, which is the number. You know, I always am nervous about somebody just in the application process giving a Social Security number. I like it better when an employer says, pending background check, we're tentatively interested in hiring you. And then they ask for the Social Security information. It's a dumb thing for an employer with a prospect they don't even know if they're interested in hiring to ask for a Social Security number, because then that information is in their database. They get hacked. They then have to deal with the lawsuits for having been hacked. And they did not show proper due care by carelessly asking for a Social Security number before it was really pivotal to making a formal job offer to someone. That's just editorializing on my part. But in your case, looking for a job that involves background check, asking ultimately at some point for your Social Security number is a legitimate business purpose.
From Jackie in Texas, my 21-year-old daughter is traveling to Israel with her college in May. What is the best way to send money with her? She's an authorized user on my Discover card. I prefer to send prepaid Visa cards. Will that work?
I don't recommend that. What I do recommend, Jackie, is get her an ATM card from one of the financial institutions that allows fee-free withdrawals from ATMs. So virtually every one of the online banks offers that. And they offer so many fee-free withdrawals. So she could use the ATM card as a way to purchase things, what I call the piece of trash fake Visa or fake MasterCard, but it would be an appropriate use in this case where she's able to buy things and the money that you have deposited is money that she would have access to. The prepaid Visa cards, definitely don't recommend those. A lot of times there will be foreign currency transaction fees with those, and the law is not as protective if those numbers get compromised or the card gets stolen. So I much prefer that you set up a savings or checking account with an online bank that you're able to deposit to. She's able to use that card, and that would be the most streamlined, simplest way for her to have access to funds while in Israel. And Israel's economy is ultra modern. The ability to use various forms of payment just about anywhere, widely available. And I did not mention being able to use an iPhone or Android using Apple Pay or Android Pay and tying something into those to be able to buy things in Israel, which is an extra protection because Google and Apple both generate unique one-time use codes for transactions. And even if a retailer, restaurant, or whatever had been hacked with one of those, what are those things called? The skimmers. Skimmer device. It wouldn't matter because the number they would capture is not useful to the criminal.
And the Android one they call GPay. Now, if you're looking for that app on your phone.
Yeah, because Google has terrible marketing, and they never stop changing the names of things, and none of them are pithy or catchy like Apple does.
This is from Ronnie. My son is in the Air Force, currently stationed in Delaware, but will be deployed to Iraq in April for approximately 7 months. What is his best option for calling home on his cell phone without breaking the bank?
So first of all, Ronnie, I want you to thank your son for his service to our great nation. And we have an all-volunteer military, and what a great thing he's doing for our freedom to put his life on the line for us. As far as protecting his wallet on the cell phone, it's all app-based that you use in the case of if everybody in the family's iPhone, you use iMessage and FaceTime as the way to communicate. If you're a mixed family of iPhone and Android, or there's friends your son might want to communicate with, knowing about Google Duo, using WhatsApp, using Viber, actually having several of these apps to be able to communicate is a great idea. You're able to do voice calling or video calling with these apps for free on the data backbone instead of on a traditional cellular calling network. And so the data that he has will be able to be used for these purposes. And anywhere he has Wi-Fi while he's in Iraq on a post, normally he'll have access to Wi-Fi. Unless the post prohibits it, he'll be able to use these apps to be able to do the equivalent of phone calls and video calls. So again, thank you to him for his service. Straight ahead, I haven't lost my mind, for real. I'm going to praise one of the giant monster mega banks for doing something really forward-thinking and helpful to its customers.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, I'm going to do it. I'm always picking on the four giant monster mega banks that have more than half of banking business in the United States. Citibank, Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. Well, now it's time to praise one of them, Bank of America. And this is something I was not aware of, but I read on Jonathan Clement's website, which is called Humble Dollar. Great website for people wanting to learn more about investing and the right ways to invest and the right strategies to think about. But there's an article on Humble Dollar about how Bank of America is doing a phenomenal job with a new security center tool. You know, we have everybody we do business with admonishing us to do a better job protecting our accounts, right? They're all saying, you know, do this with your password and that with your password and this and that and the other. And we're just mere mortals. We don't have these capabilities. And besides, we don't even understand why they're telling us we're a bad person, because we don't know what we're doing that's not good to protect ourselves. So Bank of America has come up with some tools, some actual ways you can protect your account with them better. And they've come up with a device that checks how you're doing business with them and lets you know if you are doing a good job or bad job, and coaches you how to improve the security to protect your accounts you have with them. So it tells you standard, enhanced, advanced, high, and then it will tell you where you are on the scale with how you're protecting your accounts with them. And they do it in simple steps. They tell you step by step, and there's, let's see, how many steps? It's a little bit of effort for a BOA customer. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different steps that you can go through. It's almost like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You go up the steps, you're making more progress in life. This is like that for protecting your accounts. With a bank or a credit union, the burden is on a bank if your account gets hacked as an individual consumer. With a business, it's a different set of rules. And you have to show that you were taking good care of your accounts. There's a different legal definition for it. But as a consumer, the bank gets stuck with the loss in most cases, and almost all cases, except with that hideous Zelle payment app that is atrocious. Don't use Zelle. And if it's activated on your account, shut it down. But other than that, the bank is the responsible party if somebody hacks into any of your accounts. So what Bank of America is doing is ultimately to their self-interest, but it's really great because they make it so clear in their security center how to do a better job of protecting your money. Because even though ultimately the bank or credit union is responsible when your account gets hacked into, it's a hassle and it's uncertainty and you don't have the money in that intervening period of time. It creates unnecessary anxiety. So Bank of America has, I guess, about 12 or 14% of Americans do business with them. That's a huge percent of the American population. that has access to this Bank of America Security Center tool to improve how you're handling security. And yes, I did it. I came with praise for one of the four monsters.
Nice. Well, while you're on that subject, yes. I thought I would read this one from Thomas in Virginia. In 2019, I bought my first home and the mortgage was picked up by Wells Fargo. Forward to 2020, when the pandemic hit, Wells Fargo, like many other banks, allowed you to furlough your mortgage, which I did for protection through the uncertainty with everyone's job in question. I was shocked, as well as my father, that they lowered my interest rate by a full percentage point when they renegotiated my mortgage post-furlough. I was at 4.125% and I'm now at 3.25%. Even though I seemingly have a rare case of good business with them, should I still be concerned having my mortgage with them and find a new mortgage lender? Or is this an area where I can stay and just pay off my mortgage as fast as possible?
Stay and pay. I mean, Thomas, this is the one I call the criminal enterprise impersonating a bank. And Wells Fargo complied with the federal law that allowed you, if you showed hardship, to temporarily suspend your payments and still be considered to be current. And as part of the workout agreement, they ended up lowering your rates at the end of the forbearance period with COVID. And so this was a win for you. And for them, the advantage is you didn't go somewhere else and refi and take the business from them. So this case, I think they earned your business. Rates are higher now than what you've got. You just stick with it. And with any lender, not just Wells Fargo, I want you to go use a free amortization program. You just go on the web and everybody's got them. You know, just search mortgage amortization schedule. You put in the date your loan started, the balance at that time, the interest rate, and you can print out a schedule that shows what your balance should reflect every month. If you make extra payments, you can do that. On your phone, you can download one of the financial calculators apps that will do these calculations. Because the real problem comes, particularly for people who make extra payments of principal, that the lender doesn't reflect those properly, and it costs you money and time in the loan, or your mortgage is sold. And so often the balance is picked up inaccurately higher by the acquiring mortgage servicer. So you always want to have that AM schedule, particularly when you're notified your loan is sold.
From Jamie in Florida, our daughter is 28 years old and very adventurous. She lived on her own in Barcelona, traveled alone to Bogota and numerous Central American countries. She works from home and plans to go to Mexico City to live and work from an Airbnb for all of April to enjoy the sights of Mexico City and the surrounding areas. She's very friendly, has a flashy smile, attractive, and a little naive and overly trusting. We are very, very concerned about her safety, which was furthered by the State Department releasing a statement warning Americans not to travel to Mexico because of the large increase in crime. Clark, would you please comment as to what you would tell your daughter if she expressed interest in doing the same by herself? If you would not object to her going or realize she couldn't be swayed, what advice would you give her?
I would have her read the State Department warning. Now, just between us, the State Department warning is more about areas of rural Mexico where there's complete lawlessness now, and areas are controlled by various drug gangs and their rivals. And the deaths have been brutal, hideous, barbaric. I mean, it's been unbelievable. Mexico City has been much more street crime kind of things like you'd find in any American city or suburb right now. And Mexico City is not as much a danger. If she has traveled repeatedly in Latin America, she may be potentially a little more savvy than you give her credit for. But I think that a parent's worry is the same as my worry would be. My daughter traveled to Mexico, a rural part of Mexico, as part of a group. And even being in part of a group, she was doing so when she was, your daughter's 28. My daughter did it at 17. And that was pretty nerve-wracking for me because of the area she was traveling in Mexico. There had been some ugly incidents that had occurred. So I think that your daughter, having traveled in Colombia and other places in Latin America, is probably doing the full eye roll when you try to talk to her about it. But I think just having a quiet discussion with her about the importance of being really careful, and having, I don't know if she has any friends she established over the travel to Spain or in Latin America who are people from Mexico City, but having a network of people who she knew beforehand and she knows she can trust in Mexico City would be really great. The State Department warnings, though, are pretty sobering, but they're not really about Mexico City.
From Sterling in Georgia, Clark stated his credit score fluctuates monthly because of seasonal business charges. When you pay your credit card balance in full every month, how does the credit bureau get a balance other than zero? I thought credit card reports the balance after the payment only. What am I missing here?
So Sterling, that's how you'd hope it works, but that's not how the credit reporting system works. So I'm just going to keep the numbers simple. Let's say I had a charge balance of $5,000 in the course of the month, and then I pay that balance in full, showing a zero balance remaining. But the way it works with credit reporting is the balance on the closing date, that is the one that's the great, that then establishes the grace period that you can pay your balance in full and pay no interest. The balance on the closing date is what's reported to the credit bureau. So that, even though you're paying everything net, paying in full, it is your balance at the time of statement close that develops the ratio that affects 30% of your credit score. Now, you can, let's say you're going to do a major purchase, particularly a home loan, and having the highest credit score possible is very much to your advantage. With your credit cards, what you do is you monitor the balance online and pay your bill in full before the statement closing date. And then what will be reported to the bureaus is a balance of zero or near zero, any transactions that would post in the day two or three before your payment's been posted would be reported as the balance instead of what it was to that point. I hope that made sense, because as a practical matter, it makes no sense at all that the roughly third of people who pay their balances in full every month are still treated as if they were running a balance that they're not effectively carrying. I want to remind you that we work so hard. Our journalists is a word that's overused and abused, but I want to tell you the people who work on Clark.com are true journalists. And we do the research, the deep digging, to make sure that the content that we provide you there is content that you can trust, that is thorough, and written in a way that you can act upon it in your life. So when you do have a chance, check out the content we have for you. New content, fresh content, posted every single day at Clark.com. And speaking of every day, we have free newsletters available to you. You can sign up for and choose the rotation you want for how often you receive them. If you go to clark.com/newsletters.